Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, December 11th, 2015. Canada welcomes Syrian refugees.
C-A-N-A-D-A.
Tell me, what's a Douglas fir?
C-A-N-A-D-A.
Bet you never heard of bobcat purr.
C-A-N-A-D-A.
Have you ever seen a lobster crawl?
In Canada, we get to see them all.
Yes, we trot out Rafi to open our podcast today. We need a little lightheartedness. It's been such a deadly run of events recently. And Canada is setting, I think, an excellent example for the United States after we descended into the depths of hate, bigotry, and fear-mongering this week, driven by Donald Trump. Canada is welcoming refugees from Syria. And the new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau himself, was there in Toronto Thursday afternoon to greet a group that flew in. And another flight is scheduled to land in Montreal on Saturday. And they're a little behind his campaign promise. He said they'd bring in 25,000 by the end of December, and they'll probably hit that mark by the end of February. But when you look at the United States, which in my view is directly responsible for the refugee crisis, there are more than 60 million people worldwide who are not in the homes where they used to live. Many of these people have been driven out by America's elective wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we have a seminal role in the ongoing conflict in Syria, where we've been trying to take out Bashar al-Assad, and now our former henchmen, the Islamic State, have turned on us, and we have a huge mess on our hands. And the U.S. was willing to accept a paltry number of Syrians, but now, with Donald Trump, who's been elected to nothing and speaks for nobody except his own fat head, we see the United States slamming the proverbial gates of our borders shut, and we should put a shroud over the Statue of Liberty if this is the way we're going to operate. And I applaud the Canadians for their courageous role in confronting the problems in the human condition and doing what they can to address them. I also want to salute Martin O'Malley. I think he should be polling much higher than the 3-5% that he is in the Democratic presidential contest. He's an interesting guy who has a good progressive track record in many respects, not all. And I want to applaud his recent moves. Yesterday, he went to Joe Arpaio's backyard, Maricopa County, Phoenix, Arizona, and he stood in front of a corporate prison, one of the lockups where immigrants are held. And O'Malley said, "I came here to Arizona today to say we must end the shameful practice of mass immigrant detention centers in our country. This is not in keeping with the United States of America, not in keeping with our principles as a people, not how we are a moral leader in this world, and it's not how we're able to give our children a better and more just future." Now, as you may know, private operators manage under federal contracts a lot of the prisons where we lock up non-citizens. And there is a bed mandate which Republicans have written into federal law, which obliges the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to keep 34,000 detainees a day in custody. And this is not driven by immigration policy. A quote from Francisca Porches of Puente Human Rights Movement in Phoenix. "It's driven by money and by numbers. It's time to shut it down and allow people to fight their cases from the outside." And she said it's important for O'Malley to take this stand and actually move the conversation more to the left, where we're talking about people's humanity. We're talking about the trauma people suffer inside detention, about families being separated. Well, I commend Martin O'Malley for taking these positions. I hope it gains him some traction in the campaign. Today, O'Malley flew to Sterling, Virginia, where he became apparently the first presidential candidate to appear at a mosque during this campaign cycle. And he said, "The sort of language you hear from Donald Trump is not the language of America's future. I know the language of America's future. I speak to our young people under 30 every day, and I rarely find among them any that feel like Donald Trump. And so O'Malley is ignoring this wave of hysteria that has shown many people nodding their heads as Donald Trump demagogues these issues. And the polls reflect that there are many people who embrace the hateful message that Trump has launched. And O'Malley isn't shy. He's referred to Trump as a carnival barker, and he has more recently called him out for his fascist demagoguery. And I think those terms apply quite well to Trump's latest posturing. In the show file for today's podcast, I'm linking to quite a few items for your weekend perusal. One is a very impressive, detailed piece by my friend Peter Van Buren, the State Department veteran left as a whistleblower after he exposed the boondoggles of Iraqi reconstruction. And today at Tom Dispatch, Van Buren asks, who will fight the Islamic State for us? And you may recall yesterday, I cited a new NPR poll of millennials, people between 18 and 29. And by a wide margin, 60%, they want American boots on the ground in the Middle East. And by a wider margin, 85%, they don't want to wear those boots. And so the U.S. is looking for someone, anyone, to fight this war and vanquish this foe. And Van Buren is well positioned to take us on a quick tour of the possible allies who could help us. He notes that recently Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Trump have all suggested that the war needs to shift to Arab or Muslim nations and their fighters. Van Buren says they may all mean well, but their plans are guaranteed to fail. Then he goes through group by group why. He talks about the Gulf Arabs, saying keep in mind that the realities of the region seldom seem to play much of a part in Washington's thinking. For the Gulf Arabs, all predominantly Sunni nations, the Islamic State and its Al-Qaeda-linked Sunni ilk are little more than a distraction from what they fear most, the rise of Shia power in places like Iraq and the growing regional strength of Iran. In this context, imagining such Arab nations as a significant future anti-Islamic state force is absurd. Then he takes a look at the Kurds and says that while they're the most effective fighters in the area today, that there are limits on what they're willing to do. They won't fight America's battles in parts of the region no matter how we arm and advise them. And it seems unlikely that once in control of extended swaths of northern Iraq and parts of Syria, they will simply abandon their designs on territory that's now a part of Turkey. They want a Kurdistan out of this, and the more we empower them, the more nervous it makes Turkey. And then he gets to Turkey, and he says, don't hold your breath waiting for the Turks to lend a serious military hand against the Islamic State. Turkey's government has, at the very least, been turning a blind eye to the smuggling of arms into Syria for IS, and is clearly a conduit for smuggling its oil out onto world markets. Then he talks about the Sunnis in general. It's unlikely in the extreme that local Sunnis will buy into basically the same deal that we used during the much-vaunted and failed surge in Iraq. Then he talks about the Shias, particularly those militias fighting in Iraq. He says several powerful Shia militias recently announced their opposition to any further deployment of U.S. forces to their country. The Shias are also throwing up a Shia shitstorm over Turkey's deployment of troops into Iraq, and we'll get to that later in this report. But the bottom line, Peter Van Buren concludes that Secretary of State Kerry can join the calls for the use of indigenous forces as often as he wants, but the reality is clear. Washington's policy in Syria and Iraq is bound to fail, no matter who does the fighting. And unrelated, an op-ed in Friday's New York Times, penned by, his name is Shmuel Rosner, political editor of the Jewish Journal, and a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute, writing from Tel Aviv. He says, looking back in the first Gulf War, Poppy Bush kept Israel out of it. In the invasion of Iraq, W kept Israel out of it. And when Obama raised what he calls a half-hearted coalition against the Islamic State, Israel was not asked publicly to participate. But he says insistence on keeping Israel isolated is a relic. It may have made sense when the Middle East was still preoccupied with the Arab-Israeli conflict. It makes less sense today, he argues. Well, I present this for your consideration, and just so you know the range of views that are out there, I don't particularly embrace it. Israel is already involved on a covert basis, and they have bombed in Syria to, in their view, protect the Golan Heights. They've also done some adventurous bombing in Syria. And to add them to this multi-headed hydra at this stage seems really crazy to me. But as there are no rational options that appear more attractive, I present that for you to consider. And as I mentioned, Iraq's prime minister has ordered his foreign ministry to file an official UN complaint over what he calls a violation of Iraqi sovereignty by Turkey. Abadi said today the presence of Turkish troops was a blatant breach of the UN Charter, not authorized by Iraqi authorities. We demand the Security Council take responsibility and order Turkey to immediately withdraw its troops. And likewise, as I referenced a moment ago, it is the pro-Iranian Shia elements, and we put the Shias in charge of the Iraqi government, who are putting up resistance. And, of course, I can't say that I don't blame them. Turkey is it's an operator with its own agenda, and we dodged a bullet when they shot down the Russian jet, and we're, I think, fortunate that Vladimir Putin didn't decide to retaliate in kind, which could have invoked a NATO response requirement that could widen this into a world war that many people seem to be expecting, if not seeking. Meanwhile, five Palestinian citizens of Israel have been arrested in recent weeks on suspicion of supporting the Islamic State, acquiring rifles, practicing shooting. The five suspects range in age from 18 to 27. They all have the same last name, so it appears they are related. About 34 Arab citizens of Israel have been arrested over the last year on suspicion of activities related to the Islamic State, according to Shin Bet, the security agency in Israel. And Palestinian citizens of Israel account for about 20% of the nation's population. Donald Trump, after being rebuked in what I consider to be just a rote fashion by Benjamin Netanyahu for his anti-Muslim comments this week, has canceled his trip that was planned for December 28th to visit Netanyahu in Israel. And always the spinmeister, he said, at a later date, after I become president of the U.S., I will reschedule my visit to Israel. And, of course, I thought it would be interesting to see these two demagogues get together, but apparently they thought better of it, and it's probably better for everyone that we don't see the two of them getting together and issuing some kind of a joint statement at this time. The New York Times today has an interesting piece comparing Donald Trump to the hatemonger of France, Marine Le Pen. Marine Le Pen and her father have been part of this nationalist party, the National Front, for many years. The National Party, the National Front, gained some seats in recent legislative elections around France. And it's interesting because the Times basically presents Marine Le Pen as slightly more moderate than Donald Trump. Says Trump on Monday evoked comparisons to Ms. Le Pen and her European counterparts with his call to close American borders to Muslims. Le Pen said that was too much for her, perhaps in part because she feared jeopardizing the progress she had made in shedding her party's previous image as racist and anti-Semitic. Seriously, have you ever heard me say something like that when asked about Trump's comment? Europe is on edge following the Friday the 13th attacks in Paris and other tensions that have surfaced. In Finland, the police arrested two Iraqi twin brothers who were suspected of being members of the Islamic State and of shooting 11 unarmed prisoners in Iraq way back in 2014. And it is reported that the men arrived in Finland in September, but it's not known if they came in with the wave of immigrants or if they were granted asylum status. We don't know those details so far. And yesterday, Geneva, Switzerland was rattled by a raise in the threat level, the level of alert. Additional police were deployed in an apparent search for suspects. And so far, I don't have any reports of anything substantial occurring as a result. And despite all of this security and the security surrounding the climate change conference in Paris, well, another embarrassment for the French law enforcement agencies and perhaps their equivalent of the Secret Service. Now, we've had our own embarrassing moments with the Secret Service in the past couple of years in this country. But today, an armed robber snatched an estimated 1 million euros worth of jewelry from a Chopard store in Paris, just a few doors away from France's presidential palace, the Elysee Palace. This brazen robbery was carried out. The man said that he had a gun, walked into the jewelry store in broad daylight, and walked out with over $1 million worth of jewels. And this is the third embarrassing event. Last January, a drone was flying over the Elysee Palace and embarrassed the authorities. And a few months later, one of the security officers tasked with protecting the president accidentally discharged his gun in a bathroom at the Elysee Palace. So not great days for the security teams there in France. And speaking of the climate change conference, it does appear that they're pretty close to some sort of a deal or a compact. And the focus is on sending what they call signals to the markets in order to get people to move money away from fossil fuels and toward clean energy sources, renewable sources. The Times reports that the emerging pact would require countries to enact plans to cut their fossil fuel emissions, set up a system for rich countries to pay for poor countries to mitigate and adapt to the changes of climate, and establish a legally binding timetable for countries to ratchet up the strength of their emission plans over time. But the agreement so far dodges the issue of how countries would monitor, verify, and report their levels of emissions. So it may be a long weekend for those folks in Paris. And I know that people are planning demonstrations in New York and also in violation of the edict in Paris. They may take to the streets there and confront the authorities. So it could get very interesting in the next few days. Every day here, I like to pause and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Janet Price is a longtime supporter who doubles her contribution each month. Alto has a monthly subscription, and I got a message from PayPal today that Alto has taken out an additional subscription. Thank you very much, Double Alto. Grant Gibson from Portland has been with us for a long time, and Annette McManus also does more than she has to support the PBC podcast. I'd like you to join them. I need your help, and if it's holiday time that can cause you to pull the trigger or click that mouse, I would appreciate it if you do so. Come to peterbcollins.com, click the menu button in the upper right corner, then choose Become a Subscriber, and from there you can pick $5, $10, $20 a month, our $50 annual subscription. And by the way, Android users, I feel a little bad because I had let you believe that any day now I would have a solution for you. But my contact at the company that has an Android app for podcasts is traveling for the next week or so. So I won't be able to get in touch and offer you that update for about another week. But we are working on it. I don't exclude our Android users. Yesterday, I recorded a podcast and immediately released it at Boiling Frogs Post, my weekly processing distortion podcast. And Sabelle Edmonds was kind enough to make it available unrestricted from day one. And I will link to it in the show file for this podcast. In it, I reviewed 13 lingering questions from the events 9 days ago in San Bernardino, California. The active shooter drill that was underway, the eyewitness accounts of 3 shooters, not 2, the eyewitness descriptions of the shooters that would not match 90-pound, 5'3", Tafshin Malik, the wife. And there are other very important questions that the media seems to have very little interest in. And I hope you'll listen and think critically. And if you have any contributions of items that you've seen that are unresolved or contradicted in the narratives of the events in San Bernardino, feel free to share them with me. Peter@peterbcollins.com is my email address. And the investigation is now focusing on Enrique Marquez, the friend of Farouk, Saeed Farouk, who apparently purchased the shooter's weapons, the semi-automatic rifles. And that makes him a straw man. Now, we know that Marquez checked himself into a mental health facility right after the events on December 2nd. We're told that he has been speaking for hours with federal investigators, that he waived his right to remain silent and not incriminate himself. And it appears that's a real stupid move because the information that he's giving about purchasing these so-called assault rifles is a criminal event. And he also disclosed that he and Saeed Farouk had talked about an attack back in 2012. That could be met with a conspiracy charge that could be given the fact that Farouk wouldn't be there to testify, could lead to a slam dunk conviction. And Marquez has admitted that he engaged in a sham marriage to win immigration rights for his bride, a Russian woman who is the sister of one of the Farouk brothers' wives. It gets a little complicated. At any rate, he apparently has admitted to people that his wife won't kiss him. It was just an arrangement for immigration purposes for her. And he seems to be a guy who's down on his luck. He had a job at Walmart, and they have fired him. And if he is speaking to the authorities without a lawyer, he could be looking at a long stretch in federal prison. And again, this would be based on a lot of information that we have still seen no evidence or documentation for, including the Facebook post that we're told that Malik posted either shortly before or while she was shooting up the Inland Regional Center from her burner phone. I mean, there's just too much here that begs explanation. Don Siegelman is a man that I've talked about many times on this program, and we've talked with Don Siegelman and his supporters. He's the former Democratic governor of Alabama, railroaded into federal prison by friends of Karl Rove. And I just learned this morning that for the past 8 weeks, Don Siegelman has been in the hole. He's being held at the federal lockup in Oakdale, Louisiana. And on October 15th, Siegelman, with permission, conducted a telephone interview on Tom Hartman's radio show. And during the interview, where Siegelman was advocating for prison reform, an official told him to hang up the phone and then immediately moved him to a higher security facility and placed him in solitary confinement, where he languishes today. He was not permitted visits with his family over Thanksgiving and has been denied regular phone calls and other access. President Obama presided over a bipartisan celebration as he signed reforms to the No Child Left Behind education law, and there are also some reforms to the Common Core law that he has championed. And while this is spun up as a bipartisan way of Washington listening to local educators and giving them the latitude that they need, This is a victory for Republicans who say that the federal government has no role in education policy. And, as we know, many Republican presidential candidates promise to blow up the Department of Education if they get elected. And while the president celebrates this bipartisan moment, we should consider the slope that he is slipperizing. I know that's not a word, but it sure sounded good. Antonin Scalia apparently heard Donald Trump's ravings and said, "Gosh, is it racism week in the United States?" Because he's drawn a lot of criticism for comments he made during oral arguments at the Supreme Court on Wednesday. And this is about affirmative action at the university level. Scalia noted that one of the briefs in the case pointed out that most of the black scientists in this country don't come from schools like the University of Texas. And then he departed from any fact-based argument and rambled into this zone. He said they come from lesser schools where they don't feel that they're being pushed ahead in classes that are too fast for them. "I'm just not impressed by the fact that the University of Texas may have fewer. Maybe it ought to have fewer." Well, this is the kind of paternalistic racism that many of us believe we have eradicated. But we are not post-racial. And in about a week, I'll be presenting some in-depth interviews with two authors who are experts on race, one of whom has written a powerful book rejecting this whole notion of a post-racial America. And finally, today, The Edge has won his controversial effort for approval to build 5 mansions on a pristine part of the Malibu coastline. It's been going on for nearly 10 years. As David Evans, the legal name of The Edge, made a proposal and had to pass muster with California's Coastal Commission. And I can tell you that's not easy. And finally, after he scaled back the plan and condensed the footprint of the development to a much smaller portion on this ridge that is lower down in elevation and will be less visible from a distance, the Coastal Commission agreed to approve his project. Well, I don't think he'll be inviting me over. And he will face other hurdles to build on these properties, but at least he has cleared the Coastal Commission here in California. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. I encourage you to share this podcast far and wide with people who you think might be interested. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails.